From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week, we're talking money, honey. Or, well, lack thereof, like in Puerto Rico.
I had three stores here, and I've closed two of them already. I used to have 17 employees working for me. Now there's only two.
Puerto Rico faces four times the debt of Detroit and a 45% rate of poverty. And then?
I can make the dreams of the girls come true in a gown.
What we really spend to make a quinceañera dream come true, ¿vale la pena? Also, the money to be made from immigration reform, mobile banking for the unbanked in the Bay Area, and our series on the dearly deported continues. All coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week we're talking money. Now, it hasn't been front page news, but the new title for Puerto Rico, it's being called the Greece of the Caribbean, and not because of its mild weather and sandy beaches. It's because Puerto Rico is at risk of going broke. The official unemployment rate is almost 15%, over twice what it is here on the mainland. The poverty rate on Puerto Rico, 45%. And now, there's fear that the U.S. territory might default on its debt. Latino USA's Marlon Bishop reports now on how the island is coping.
Let's say you're a visitor from another planet, and you've been dropped in the middle of the Plaza Las Americas shopping mall in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I'll tell you what you wouldn't think. You wouldn't think, wow, this is a place that's fallen on hard times. To the untrained eye, Plaza Las Americas looks packed with happy shoppers. But
para hacer un viernes, está vacío.
For a Friday, it's empty, says Sofia Peña, who works at a cell phone kiosk. She says this time of year, there should be a lot more people here. Shopping is a national pastime in Puerto Rico, so much so that several retailers' most profitable locations in the world are here in this mall. But 7 years of continuous recession have taken their toll.
I think that every Puerto Rican has had to make changes in their lifestyle.
That's shopper Maricel Rios.
I have to cut down a little bit on extra expenses, and I've been focusing more in savings because I have college kids. And, well, I have to think about the future very carefully now.
Everyone seems worried about the economy. A lot. Security guard Eduardo Cintron says the prosperity on display here at Plaza Las Americas, it's a mirage.
All the people that are here, they only spend with the card, the credit card. More debt.
More debt and more debt. Cintron may as well be talking about the island itself. The Puerto Rican government is $70 billion in the red. That's almost four times what the bankrupt city of Detroit owes. It's a similar debt load to the state of New York, which has more than five times the population. And now there's worry among bondholders that Puerto Rico could default. How exactly did this happen?
Well, there was an economic model that came to an end.
That's economist Vicente Feliciano. He says the Puerto Rican economy grew at a healthy clip for decades, thanks to huge federal tax breaks that lured corporations to set up factories here.
It was growing like at Asian levels.
Puerto Rico achieved one of the highest living standards in all of Latin America. But then, in the 1990s,
the federal government eliminated those tax incentives.
It was like a death sentence for the Puerto Rican economy. By the time the tax breaks were fully phased out in 2005, much of the island's industry had evaporated. The government began to borrow money, a lot of it, to make up for the lost corporate tax revenue. Feliciano explains it like this.
You know, your salary's caught, so you start taking on money from your credit card, and there comes a point that you max out. Guess what? You have to cut back on your living standards, and we have been going through that process.
Essentially, Puerto Rico has maxed out. Rating agencies downgraded the island's bonds to near junk status in late 2012, making it difficult to borrow. So far, there's no federal bailout on the table. The government has promised it will not default. Instead, it is taking tough measures in order to raise cash.
The debt is being paid, but paying that debt has involved certain sacrifices of the general public.
In other words, Puerto Ricans are really hurting. The Paseo de Diego is a working-class shopping district in San Juan. With a little imagination, you can almost see the tumbleweeds rolling down the street. Many storefronts are empty. Everywhere you look, signs offer clearance prices. Inside Kelvis Polo's shop, traffic is slow. Polo began his professional life 17 years ago as a street vendor and slowly worked his way up to become the proud owner of several apparel stores.
I had three stores here and I've closed two of them already. I used to have 17 employees working for me. Now there's only two.
Lots of factors are conspiring to bury him. Take the power bill.
For a place like this, I pay $1,700 a month for electricity.
Power is extremely expensive in Puerto Rico, higher than in any U.S. state except Hawaii. And the government has imposed a flurry of new taxes. There's sales taxes, gas taxes, corporate taxes. Water rates went up 60% this year. The cost of living is high and wages are staying flat. Polo's customers have no money to spend.
We small businessmen are the backbone of any country's economy, but we don't have the strength to keep going.
Polo plans to close his last store in January and go back to selling in the street, where he started and where he'll have no rent or electric bill to pay. The government's new taxes will raise an estimated $1.4 billion. They're a step towards meeting the goal of balancing the budget by 2016. They've also provoked a lot of anger, a sense that the government is just digging in the knife. But David Chafee, a top government financial officer, says the administration didn't have much choice. It was either raise taxes or cut spending drastically.
The governor felt that cutting expenses to that amount would have been quite painful to a lot of people. These are some of the decisions that you're facing, but in a way you just have to do them. And maybe for the past 8 or 10 years, different administrations had been able to postpone on some of those decisions. But at this stage, given all the things that we were facing, these were things that we had to do.
But those things have created some fallout.
When you see people, young people like myself, living the island, they do it very calmly. And that is completely understandable.
30-year-old Mario Alberghini, an entrepreneur, wants to stay in Puerto Rico. But, he says, given the current outlook, it's not easy getting a business going.
Because at a certain level, you sort of don't know what's going to happen. Like there is this certainty that something's going to happen. We just don't know what it is.
That's the question. Eventually, economists say, a recovery will come. Salaries will likely be lower than on the mainland, and that could make Puerto Rico attractive to businesses again. For now, the one thing that is clear is that things are likely to get worse before they get better. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
So people on the island of Puerto Rico have a lot to be worried about right now. But since they're born American citizens, one thing Puerto Ricans don't have to worry about is immigration reform, or rather, the lack of movement on immigration reform. The Latino USA newsroom covers this issue a lot, and for a minute there, we did think we might see some reform before year's end. The Senate passed their bipartisan immigration bill in the summer, but then... nada.
And frankly, I'll make clear, we have no intention of ever going to conference on the Senate bill.
Speaker John Boehner says the House will address the issue on its own terms. This comes despite pressure from the Senate, from the business community, evangelicals, and most recently and most dramatically, from immigrants and their allies who have been fasting in front of the White House for over a month now. But Congress has adjourned for the holidays, so reform will have to wait until the new year. And We often talk about immigration reform in terms of the human cost, the loss of lives, families torn apart, the lack of due process, the conditions of detention. But what about the money side of the equation? A report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says immigration reform would actually increase our GDP by tens of billions of dollars each year. Billions. Walter Ewing is senior researcher at the American Immigration Council.
Every time a new group of immigrants comes in, whether it's Italians or Irish or Mexicans or Salvadorans, the claim is always the same. They're going to hurt us. They're going to drive down our wages. They're going to drain our social services. And that ends up not being the case.
One major point of contention surrounding any proposed reform is a path to citizenship. Ewing says granting undocumented workers legal status would again give the U.S. economy a much-needed boost.
Undocumented immigrants would earn more. If you earn more, you spend more, and you invest more, and you save more, and you are more likely to start a business.
An even bigger workforce also translates into greater tax revenue. According to the Congressional Budget Office, immigration reform could reduce the federal deficit by $1 trillion over the next 20 years. Roel Campos is a former Securities and Exchange Commissioner. He says the best research we have shows immigrant workers not only benefit the economy, but they aren't an economic threat because they don't steal jobs.
In fact, what happens is that, you know, because they're not, oftentimes they don't have the same skill sets that Americans do, they create their own work. They set up their own businesses. They do work that other American workers don't care to do. Work in fields, work in restaurants, work in hotels.
Immigrants also tend to be entrepreneurs. They're more than twice as likely to start a small business than the native-born population. And Campos says current policy costs the U.S. in potential tax revenues. But we're also losing out, he says, on innovation and creative capital.
We're educating the high-level people with masters and other graduate degrees and PhDs, and then they cannot stay in the U.S. even if they want to. And so after educating them, we send them away, and then they go live in other parts of the world who get the benefit of the education that the U.S. provided for them.
Immigrants also make up an astounding number of PhDs in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. The National Survey of College Graduates reports that 40% of all science PhDs and 60% of engineering PhDs are people born in other countries.
If we had a comprehensive immigration reform bill, that bill would provide for very high-skilled individuals coming from other places around the world to do jobs in Silicon Valley, in the East, all over America.
So can 2014 bring the economic and immigration changes the United States stands to benefit from? Well, hope is wearing thin, but stay tuned, queridos. We'll be here to let you know. Coming up on Latino USA's Money Edition, how would you like to decide, really decide, where the money is spent?
You have people that can go out there and explain to their peers, this is how the process works.
Participatory budgeting, an experiment in direct democracy in Spanish Harlem. That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Business owners from both political parties have made the case for immigration reform. But it isn't often you hear a conservative Republican talking about one of their businesses being raided by immigration agents, which is the exact story I heard from conservative commentator Linda Chavez, who I met for the first time this past summer when we both sat on a panel together. I was so intrigued by her story, I wanted her to tell it to a national audience. And so we're joined on the line now by Linda Chavez from Denver, Colorado. Welcome back to Latino USA, Linda.
Great to be with you.
You told a story that, frankly, I thought most people would, I don't know, be ashamed to tell. You talked about serving on the board of this company, Pilgrim's Pride, a poultry processing plant, and you talked about what happened when your company was raided. So what did happen?
Well, first of all, Pilgrim's Pride, which at the time of this raid was the single largest poultry company in America, did everything right. We were one of the very first large employers to sign up for E-Verify. So nobody was ever hired who was not filtered through the E-Verify system with the federal government. We certainly provided our workers with decent working conditions. We paid top wages in the industry. And yet, we couldn't find enough American workers to take the jobs. And therefore, there were very large numbers of foreign-born persons working for Pilgrim's Pride. It turned out that some of the employees used Social Security numbers that were not their own.
And when the raid happened, you had no clue that there was going to be a raid?
We did actually. We were notified by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that someone did a cross-check of Social Security numbers that were on the employees' records and found that those were not, in fact, valid Social Security numbers. And the company was raided. About 400 employees were rounded up. And the company ultimately was fined, although there was no criminal or civil penalties imposed. The company was ultimately settled with the government for a fine of $4.5 million.
Now, right after the raid, the company basically said, okay, we're going to look for local workers, you know, basically all American citizens. What happened then?
What happened was the company did everything they could to replace these workers and struggled with it. We increased the wages on some of the jobs, provided transportations in some of the places. And what happened was we had a great difficulty doing that. We found that many of the people who were hired on did not stay. They stayed a few days, some stayed a week. And there was enormous turnover. And that happened at a time when the company was actually struggling with higher feed costs, higher fuel costs, and credit tightening up. The raid took place in April. By the fall of 2008, Pilgrim's Pride went into bankruptcy. And there's no doubt in my mind that among the factors that led to that bankruptcy was the fact that the company had such difficulty finding employees under our immigration laws. Americans do not want to take jobs in poultry plants. However, those are very good jobs if you've come from a society in which no jobs are available, in which you've had very limited education, and you see those jobs as a stepping stone. That's what those jobs mean to immigrants. And that's why so many employers are eager to hire those immigrant workers. They see these jobs as an opportunity to become fully a part of American society.
Do you worry that there is a problem of abuse of authority because they come in and they, you know, they're going to raid this plant? Are you worried about that?
I am worried about it. I have to tell you that one of the long time employees of Pilgrim's Pride, this was what might be described as a Texas good old boy, said to me when he was describing what the raids looked like. He said it looked like the Gestapo coming in. He said these people were covered in riot gear, and he said he just couldn't believe the amount of terror that it struck throughout the line that day when those raids took place.
And when you tell these kinds of stories, the authorities in the Republican Party, the leadership of the Republican Party, is not happy that Linda Chavez is saying there's something wrong with immigration policy.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There are those in the Republican Party who understand this. First of all, employers understand it. These people are not here to go on welfare. They're here to take jobs that American employers need them to take. You know, we have a choice in America. We can either import workers to take some of these jobs, or we can export the jobs. I mean, you can pick up and move poultry processing entirely south of the border. We don't have to raise chickens in the United States. Of course, if we do that, a lot of the small farming communities in the rural South and other places are going to dry up and die as a result. And it's not just going to be the Mexican-born workers who are going to lose their jobs. It's also going to be the American-born who provide these people housing, who sell them cars, who run the grocery stores and the restaurants that they eat in. That's the choice that we're facing in America. Either we fix our immigration laws and we provide employers access to employees who want these jobs and who will provide a good day's labor for an honest day's pay.
And finally, Linda Chavez, when you hear about a raid, what goes on for you?
Well, I think it's really very sad because it's clear to me that what we're doing is very, very destructive, not just of the immigrant community. It's destructive of the American economy. We're having a terrible time creating jobs in the United States. If an employer is out there and able to create a job at a car wash or a restaurant, we ought to be patting that person on the back because the money that is paid to those workers is going to go out into that community. We should not be penalizing those employers. We ought to be out there making it possible for people to do this legally. Nobody wants people to come here illegally. They should come here legally. But right now, our immigration system is so broken that they have no opportunity to come here legally. And that's what we need to fix.
Linda Chavez, thank you so much for joining us again on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Linda Chavez is a Fox News commentator and the chairwoman of the Center for Equal Opportunity, which focuses on issues of race and ethnicity.
So, do you ever wonder how our elected representatives decide on our behalf how to spend public money? Okay, so maybe you don't stay up at night thinking about this, but some people do, and they came up with a way to get you included. It's an experiment in direct democracy that aims to give the power over the public purse strings back to the people.
If you live in this community and you pay taxes, come out and vote, decide how your tax dollars get spent.
It's called participatory budgeting.
Oh, this is different because you're actually voting for where the money is going to be spent instead of allowing them to decide where to spend the money.
And it's a chance for local residents within a city or municipal district to pick the projects they want the funds to go to. People vote on it, and then city officials have to spend the money on those projects chosen by the people. You don't have to be a registered voter or even a citizen to be involved. You just have to live in the area. This process has been used in over 1,500 communities around the world. In the U.S., it's been used in my hometown of Chicago, in San Francisco and Vallejo, California, and right here in New York City.
A small shout out for the food that was donated.
At a town hall meeting in the Sunset Park neighborhood of Brooklyn this fall, community residents hashed out ideas for projects to fund in this year's cycle.
Maybe more sports centers.
Sports center?
Yeah.
It doesn't even have to be a building. It can be like maybe a little soccer field there and a little baseball field
there's
there.
There's plenty of empty space.
Like,
if you look in Sunset Park,
tell us
along Third Avenue.
Yeah,
along Third Avenue, there's so many abandoned buildings. There's so much open space.
The process is involved. Sometimes it's messy, but it's gaining traction. In New York City, it started out with four city council districts in 2011. And next year, it will grow up to 22 districts with over $20 million being voted on by local residents. To find out more about how the project is working, we spoke to one local official involved in the project, a Latina politician from Spanish Harlem. New York City Councilmember Melissa Mark Viverito represents District 8. She covers East Harlem and the South Bronx. Welcome to Latino USA, Councilwoman.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, Maria.
Just for our listeners, define what participatory budgeting is and what it actually looks like.
It's a process by which constituents are able to have a direct say in defining what priorities are within their district and then voting on those priorities. And depending on the vote, the projects that receive the highest level of participation would get funded. About 3 years ago, we kicked off with 4 council members in New York City out of 51 council members. We're now entering our third year, and the past 2 years, I've been able to allocate about $2 million in capital, which basically helps for infrastructure improvements like playground upgrades or putting in labs in public schools. It was the first year was obviously getting the word out, and in total, we had about 700 to 800 people participate. It was really encouraging to see.
So what do you remember about walking into that meeting in your district in East Harlem? What did it look like, and what was your reaction?
So I do remember one particular situation where you had some more affluent neighbors, you know, living alongside those that lived in public housing, coming into one of these conversations, and some parents that were very active in one of the local schools had a very clear idea of what they wanted to advocate for. But as they were sitting there alongside with residents in public housing who were talking about basic needs that were being overlooked, like the playground that really needed to be upgraded or the basketball court that had cracks on the floor and kids couldn't play, you started to see the priority shift. And I think that that's what's one of the beautiful aspects of this process is that people just get to know each other, get to really hear from people that may be living next door to them in some ways, but they don't really interact with. It is an educational piece, too, because people learn about the budget process. People learn about how projects are funded. And that piece is very powerful as an elected official because now you have people that can go out there and explain to their peers, this is how the process works. We have people that are immigrants that may not have status in terms of they may be undocumented. I can also participate in this process.
So what exactly have you all or together with your community residents, what have you decided to fund?
Safety issues. So cameras in our public housing developments comes up every year. We've also funded a van to help deliver meals to seniors at their homes. We also had a van that was funded to help teach people healthier eating options. It's going to be like a mobile kitchen. These are projects that were defined by the community, and then people vote.
So if you think about participatory budgeting expanding in New York City over the next several years, what does that look like?
I think what we've seen in a short period of time is us engaging in this process, and New York being New York, right? It really has drawn a lot of attention. And those of us that engaged in this process the first year, in some ways, were kind of laughed at for trying to do this. But we have seen it just really take off, and the level of interest in the mayoral debates that were happening. We heard the mayoral candidates talking about participatory budgeting because they were being asked about it.
Councilwoman Melissa Mark-Viverito, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much.
Councilmember Melissa Mark-Viverito represents District 8 in New York City, covering East Harlem in the South Bronx. She spoke to us from her offices in City Hall. Now, it may seem hard to believe in a country as wealthy as the United States that not everyone here has access to a bank. According to the FDIC, close to 10 million American households, almost 8% of the population, don't have checking or savings accounts. More than 15% of those households are made up of non-citizen immigrants. This year, the city of Oakland, California, took a bold step to provide banking services for all of its residents, regardless of their immigration status. The city is issuing municipal IDs that can also function as prepaid debit cards, so you can have an ID and now also have access to a bank account. In the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that the program is the brainchild of my brother, UCLA professor Raul Hinojosa, and his colleagues. Also in this story, the immigrants asked that we only use their first names. Radio Bilingüe reporter Farida Javala Romero has our story.
Toribio has lived in Oakland for 11 years. He's an undocumented day laborer and used to spend a lot of time on the streets looking for work. Then he was mugged by 4 people.
I was assaulted and they took my money. I had $350 in my wallet and they took all of it. I had to keep working to get money to eat. That's why it's very dangerous to be on the street with cash in your pocket, because you never know when you're going to get robbed.
Toribio knows other day laborers who have been robbed too. That's why getting an ID and prepaid debit card from the city of Oakland makes sense to him. He's still figuring out how to use the banking options on his card, but just having the ID in his hands gives him more peace of mind.
For
the simple fact that if someday the police stop me on the street, I have the security of showing my ID so they don't detain me. It's safer for me as a person living and working here.
Toribio is a textbook example of who Oakland's program aims to help.
There are groups of people that need desperately a government, an official government ID. There are those folks who need low-cost financial services, and there are those folks who need both things, right?
Dr. Paula Cruz de Cash helped come up with the idea for the card. She works with SF Global, a company that contracts with the city to market and process the card. She says Oakland has broken new ground in creating a hybrid.
They had the guts, more than any other city in the country, to take this opportunity to be able to launch what is really the first municipal ID prepaid debit card in the history, not just of this country, but in the history of humankind.
At a building in a high-crime part of Oakland, a representative from a day laborers co-op is explaining to about 20 workers what the card does. The photo ID opens doors to municipal services like the library. It can also be used for direct deposits, ATM withdrawals, and store purchases. That's what appeals to an immigrant named Jose.
It's going to make it easier for me to buy things, because it's better to have a card in your pocket than cash.
Like any other debit card, this one is issued by a bank, Sunrise Banks, headquartered in Minnesota. That gives it one key advantage over a regular ID.
The records are kept by the bank and not by the city.
Arturo Sanchez oversees the program for Oakland.
And so it affords a form of privacy protection that other cities can't offer right now that we can offer here.
With its hybrid card, Oakland can avoid problems like the one faced by New Haven, Connecticut. In 2007, New Haven became the first city in the country to issue IDs to all its residents. An anti-immigrant group tried to make all the names and addresses public to discourage undocumented immigrants from applying for the card. But in Oakland, the information is confidential. So Jose, who's undocumented, decided to go for it.
It had me very worried, but supposedly the information is kept in a bank, so it looks like there's no risk.
But the card is not cheap. It costs $2.99 a month just to keep it, 75 cents if you buy anything, at least 50 cents if you use an ATM, and $1.75 if you call customer service. Arturo Sanchez says the city is working on that.
Costs will go down as volume goes up. So the more people who have the card and the more people who use the card will eventually lead to lower fees. But we're also working on other ways to try and lower fees.
There's one more issue. Out of about 4,000 who have the ID, fewer than 100 are actually using its banking services. Community advocates and consumers say the city needs to do more outreach. Sanchez says that's also on his list.
In the eyes of a program, this is an infant. It's barely out of a womb. It has a long time to grow. We're in this for the long haul.
The long haul includes upcoming services like international money transfers. And other places are paying attention. Sanchez says he's been contacted by New York City and cities in Illinois, Connecticut, and Florida. Nearby Richmond, California, will release its prepaid debit card next year. For Latino USA, this is Farida Javala Romero in Oakland, California.
Coming up, the deported reached the 2 million mark.
Living and making money and having a great life in the city of New York, you can't compare it.
Our series on the stories of the dearly deported continues on Latino USA. Stay with us. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and coming up, another in our series we call The Dearly Deported. But first, quinceañeras. These sweet 15 celebrations are officially about a girl's transition into womanhood, and it can be a pretty glitzy affair with tiaras, dresses with petticoats, and official choreographers. In Las Vegas, where the Latino population has exploded over the past decade, so has the business of quinceañeras. Families might empty their pockets to throw a party for their mujercitas. From the Fronteras desk at Nevada Public Radio, Kate Sheehy has our story.
The mannequins in Casa de Calderon are adorned with dresses resplendent in orange, pink, and green, jeweled bodices, and layers of tulle.
I can make the dreams of the girls come through in a gown.
Elizabeth Calderon makes these elaborate gowns by hand at the shop she and her husband own in East Las Vegas. She says the dress is the most personal detail for a quinceañera.
This is incredible how it's been growing. It's very, very popular.
But style doesn't come cheap. She says sometimes parents pay several thousands of dollars just for the dress, which is only a small part of paying for a huge bash.
Sometimes you're not going to believe it, but sometimes they stop, make payments on their home. Sometimes they sell their cars.
Tonight, Jalissa Canal is in the spotlight. About 200 people fill the party hall, Palacio del Sol, for her quinceañera. But it's her mother, Erica Arellano, who's nervous. There's so many details, she says, and you're running around until the last minute because you're worried you forgot something, and also it's a lot of money. Arellano says with the help of extended family, they forked out $15,000 for the event. At the entrance is a poster-sized picture of Jalissa. The tables are decorated with silver and blue to match Jalissa's dress. There's a buffet, a fancy cake, a DJ, and later, a live band. Alberto Hernandez is the owner of Palacio del Sol. It's one of about 35 venues off of the city's casino strip that hosts these parties. Hernandez says quinceañeras are 75% of his business. He says lately, he sees more working class families struggling to pay for these huge celebrations.
It used to be people that they pay in front $7,000, $8,000 cash with no problem. And now people like coming every paycheck with $300, $400.
Many Latino immigrants, like Jalissa's mother, didn't have the money decades ago for their own glamorous Sweet 15. So these days, many times, the celebration is more important to immigrant parents than their American-raised daughters. Valerie Ochoa is a 19-year-old college student at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She says she didn't feel like turning 15 was a big deal, and she didn't want all the attention a quinceañera brings, but her grandma felt otherwise.
And so she went and she bought a big dress, she bought these really glittery shoes, and she called me into her room one day and was like, oh, come try on your quinceañera stuff.
Thankfully, Ochoa says her party was a smaller affair at her family's church, and she says she wasn't angry with her grandma.
For once, I let my grandma, like, put me in this crazy dress and do something like this for me, even though I didn't want to, but that's because I think it was important to her, so.
Back at the dress shop, Elizabeth Calderon says that for many parents, the sense of pride and tradition is worth the financial sacrifice.
They tried the best to get the special dream for their little girl.
Calderon's family didn't have the money for a fancy quinceañera for her. Still, she remembers her 15th birthday fondly. She had flowers in her hair and a cake. But she says now she designs dresses that she would have wanted to wear.
Because even the American people, they say, oh my gosh, I mean, I wish I can wear a gown like that at least once. What I think is that every woman would like to have a day like that.
For Latino USA, I'm Kate Sheehy in Las Vegas.
Do you remember a time when money was always tied to manufacturing in this country, or industry, car companies? Well, now it's all about money and technology. Today, we're talking to two tequinistas who are working to help Latinos find a place in the world of tech. First up, Luz Rivas, who is the founder of DIY Girls, a nonprofit organization that provides mentorship and hands-on technical training for young women who want to build technology. Luz joins us from NPR West in California. Just for the sake of clarity, what are we talking about when people throw out this word tech?
For me, it's a way to, an ability to create something using a variety of tools, not just for the web or mobile phones like most people think. My background is electrical engineering and I was a hardware engineer. So when I think of tech, I think of electronics, building devices. For me, it's a lot broader than just the internet.
So do you remember when it was that you said, wow, I'm like the only Latina here. I don't see any other Latinos in this field.
It was in college, maybe specifically in my department. So I went to MIT and I decided to go in electrical engineering and computer science. And it was the largest major at MIT, you know, a third of the freshman class. But there were very few Latinas. I mean, I think one per year, maybe, if any. And that's when I felt it.
So from your perspective, why is it that there are so few Latinos in technology or in engineering? Is it a lack of interest or is it the barriers?
It's definitely not a lack of interest. I think it's access to the resources to for you to get interested in the first place. Like, for example, I got interested when I was in fifth grade. The girls that I serve in our after school program, 70% of them said they don't learn about technology in school, but they're interested in it and they do want to learn to create with technology. I think what's happening too, like the girls that are now in middle school, you know, that went through our program, they're being offered technology classes, but they're just teaching them how to open Windows and type Word documents, right? And
so my level of technology.
So they went from, you know, making things in my program when they were in elementary school. And now in middle school, they are, you know, how to move the window around and how to close it. And, you know, they even tell me it's different. It's not like your technology, right? So I think in our schools where the majority of Latinos are, we're not offering them opportunities to think of themselves as a tequinista.
Why should Latinos get more involved from an economic standpoint? Does it benefit just them because they might get paid a bigger salary? Or does it benefit our larger economy and how?
Well, definitely, you know, STEM and tech careers, the salary is a lot higher compared to national averages, right? Even as at an entry-level position. But I think it also helps our communities, right, to have well-paying professionals in these careers.
And you basically, Luz, your organization is called DIY, Do It Yourself Girls. What does the future in your dreamo vision look like?
My dream is that every child will have access to the tools that they need to create and to be creative with technology. And that's what I try to do in our program. We have an elementary school classroom and we have equipment like a 3D printer. We have soldering irons. We introduce girls to electronics. So they're able to explore and create because these kids, you know, are going to be in careers in the future that haven't been invented yet. I think if they have access to our current tools, if kids have access to them today, they're able to start imagining the future.
So what do you call yourself? You know, we call ourselves tequinistas. What do you call yourself?
Maybe a geek.
From Luz Rivas, the self-described Latina geek, we move on now to Edward Avila, who is one of the founders of the Manos Accelerator. It's a program that offers Latinos and Latin Americans startup resources and mentorships to get their tech projects off the ground. Edward joins us on the phone from San Jose, California. So from your perspective, Edward, do you see Latinos active in the tech sector as you define it?
You know, surprisingly enough, you know, I see Latinos using the internet and also smartphones in huge rate, but I don't see them participating in the creation process. And that has to change. And that's really what drove me to put together the framework of an accelerator like Manos, a mentorship structured program that identifies and develops Latino entrepreneurs at the early stage.
Do you remember that moment when you were like, wait, what am I doing here? And how come there aren't more of me?
Yes, I actually, that's a good question. About 3 years ago, I actually had my own startup. You put a CEO, you know, or a co-founder title on a business card here in Silicon Valley, you get invited to a lot of networking events. And whether it was an organization or an audience of five or 500, I did find myself feeling, one, alone, two, where are the other Latinos in this space? And I kind of gravitated to the folks that actually were working the event to say, hey, where are we? We're not playing.
From your perspective, why are there so few Latinos in technology? If we are consumers and users, is it that we're not interested, that we feel like it's not our field?
I don't think that it's not an issue of interest level. In my experience, 20 years in Silicon Valley, I get inspired by the story. And the story is, hey, I'm the first generation that graduated from college. I'm the first person that actually found a job that's in high tech. And what they're needing is just mentors and advisors or just role models. And I think we just need to have more success stories out there because they're out there. I'm finding them. And I think that's really the challenge, the speed bump, if you will, that many Latinos just don't have that. And I hope to change that.
Edward, thank you so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your time.
Edward Avila is one of the founders of the Manos Accelerator. And Luz Rivas is the founder of DIY Girls. She joined us from NPR West in Los Angeles. It is a fact. Immigrants often take jobs Americans don't want to do. So, do we lose out when people who are line cooks, sanitation workers, crop pickers, and yes, taxi drivers are deported? This week, another story from our series, The Dearly Deported. Abu Firas lives now in Amman, Jordan, and he's looking for a job.
I left America on March the 30th of 2003. That was the beginning of the war, the Second Gulf War, and I was very scared and realizing that where I used to live and where I ended up coming back to my hometown and things like that, what I'm not used to, it was very hard. And I don't wish that what happened to me for other people to witness, because living and making money and having a great life in the city of New York, there is nothing, you can't compare it to anywhere else throughout the whole world. Living in the States, it's a dream for every person. It's a dream for everybody throughout the whole world. Of course, I have faced a lot of problems living back home. There is not much opportunity. Oppression exists. Doesn't matter if how qualified you can be in life. It doesn't matter if you want to apply for a job out here. You know, there's little issues about this out here. I did not find it where I was living in the States.
I used to drive a cab. You know, I found it very easy and useful to earn a living out here. And I can introduce you to doctors and nurses and engineers that drive the cab here in Amman. And in my case, I lost my job driving a taxi. Losing my job in Amman is like something big, because the laws are not in the favor of the cab driver. When it comes to a cab driver living in Amman, in Jordan, or, you know, in Jordan in general, there is no law throughout the Department of Labor that will allow you to have your own rights legally, because there is no piece of contract between a driver and the owner of the car. And he feels to fire people anytime he feel like it, because nobody cares. God knows how am I making it or how am I living it. I hope things will change. I've been planning on trying to go back to the States since day one I came back home. If I have a chance to go back to the States and I was offered to work in a translation business, I don't mind it. I love the taxi business, the limousine business. I did work at the time. Translating throughout the court systems, dealing with Arabs or native Arabic people throughout the court system, I don't mind it. I will be very happy to do such a thing. What is the most favorite things about America? The freedom, the good life, the energy. You know, you can start from scratch. I'm sorry to say that, but I don't think so many Americans appreciate what they have on the ground once they travel outside the country and see how people are living and surviving. Probably they will, you know, thank God for what they have on the ground.
Abu Firas' story came to us from reporter Dale Gavlak. And do you know someone who's been deported and wants to tell us their story? Let us know on Twitter. We're at LatinoUSA. And here's wishing you mucho dinero, queridos, but even more important, mucha salud. And that's our program for this week. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp. Special thanks to Fronteras, the Changing Americas Desk, and the Meerkat Media Collective. Additional engineering this week by Brendan Baker. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, and join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Hold on one quick second, Edward. I'm getting a weird call on my phone. Hold on a second.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.